across borders and divides. And we've got three fabulous speakers to support us and promote conversation on that journey.
Marek Kazmierski is now working in Poland as a former prison governor, but very heavily involved in some of the creative arts. You'll see that on your seats there is a copy of Not Shut Up. Marek was until recently the managing editor of this wonderful magazine and organisation. He's going to be followed by Patrick Kearney, who's a PhD student here at the University of Cambridge, who is doing a really interesting ethnography inside a faith-based care provider and community working with people with learning disabilities. So he's going to talk about that. And then we're finishing with David Newman, who's a principal geographer. So I'm going to hand over to Marek, and they're going to each speak for around 10 minutes or so, and then provoke lots of discussion. And we're going to finish as usual just before 2. Over to Marek.
There's no mic or anything, right?
There's no mic. Feel free.
I'm not going to ask if you can hear me at the back, because if you can't, well, enjoy the magazine, right?
If there's no digital stuff here.
First of all, huge thanks to Ruth and Amy for inviting me down here, even though as of 6 months ago, I'm now living abroad doing quite different things to the things I was doing up until I moved in the summer. But I want to apologise as well. First of all, I'm going to sound very stuffy today. I've got a bit of a cold, which is a problem because I'm going to be speaking very quickly because I want to cover a lot of ground in those 10 minutes that I've got. And number three, I'm also going to apologise for possibly confusing the heck out of all of you because at 5 o'clock this morning I was up thinking the thing that I was going to talk about, I'm not going to talk about because I'm going to talk about something else because I've spent the last 4 days talking to so many people who I've worked in prisons with and who are working in a range of environments related to this idea of power and connection and communication that actually the thing that I prepared is now in the bin. And the thing I want to talk about or give it a title is Mindset on Lockdown. We'll come on to why that particular title in a second, but first thing I want to do is I want to talk about Carlo Gebler. He is like me, a writer who ended up going into prison and teaching in Northern Ireland. Last year, Carlo was the keynote speaker at an event called Credibility Conference. It was a two-year EU-funded project looking at arts interventions in various prisons all across the European Union. Carlo spoke about his experience of working in prisons as an artist, and he said two things which were, to me, not just interesting, but actually fundamentally transformative and will live with me for a very long time to come. The first thing he said was, after years of going into prison and teaching creative writing, creative reading, all the things that you do as an artist intervening in prison, you do a lot more than just teaching a syllabus. Finally, after years, somebody actually asked him, why do you do this? You're a famous writer. You write for children. You write novels. You know, you make a very fine living as a writer, which, believe me, is next to impossible. And yet you find time away from your children, your own life, to come into prison and work with those who've not just been locked away from society, but they've been locked out of mind. People in prison in England are very much locked beyond the edges of society. And he said, I don't know. And he looked into it. And he found that 100 years before he started this work, his family actually came from Germany. They were German Jews who were escaping persecution already in the late 19th century and had moved as far as they could in Europe, which was up to Belfast, where they became butchers. And they lived in a community of Jewish butchers who served the Belfast community. But in 1914, the First World War kicked off. And because they had German passports, the Garda simply showed up at their door, arrested them as enemies of the state, and locked the men up for 4 years. And because they were prisoners, but they were enemies of the state, this was a war situation, they were not even given food or medicine in all the time they were in prison. So the mothers, who were left fending for the families, not only had to fend for themselves in really horrific conditions, but also had to keep the men alive in those prisons. And the consequence of this, he said, when he started to look back, impacted on his life, the life of his father, the life of his brothers, of the women, of the children, and how trauma continues, and how difficult it is to understand and analyze some of this, and why that's relevant to writing. And the second thing he said, which was really key, was he said, actually, I realize everything we do in life is emotional. From the moment we get up and we choose whether to have cornflakes, bran flakes, toast, coffee with milk or without, it's about how we feel about that, how we, the taste, the health issue, whatever. Right up until the last thing we do at night, whether we go to bed, at what time, if we go to bed with a book, what sort of a book, or whether we go to bed with somebody, and what sort of somebody. Everything we do in life is about emotions. And the problem with people beyond the edge of society is that emotions, according to Carlo, work in two ways. There's the inner narrative and the outer narrative. Your inner experience and how you share yourself with the rest of the world. And the problem with people in prison, for example, is that their lives, from word go, are already loaded with very heavy emotion, traumatizing things. And the problem is that, on the other hand, they're not given the skills to express themselves and even speak about what it is they feel, which is really problematic because there's too much up here and there's no ability to get an air and resolve any of that. If you come from a privileged background, clearly your life is going to be a little bit more calm and, you know, coherent, but also you're given the ability to speak and dress and present yourself and listen and steer your way through life. So this was fundamental to me in thinking about how I ended up as a writer working in Felton Young Offenders Institute in West London. 30,000 young men go through that prison every year. It's well known because of a horrific murder that took place there in 2000, a racist murder of a British Pakistani lad by a psychotic cellmate. I started working in Felton in 2003 as a research project. I was writing a novel about somebody who'd been in prison, and I thought it might be relevant to the process of writing it to try teaching in prison. I meant to stay for 6 months. I stayed for 2 years teaching English. Then for another 2 years, I taught creative writing with speakers of other languages. So I was doing creative writing and reading with those whose first language was not English, in prison, and for the Paul Hamlin Trust. And this project was very successful. We got extra funding, we won awards. I was loving it. Until I realized it's not all as one would wish. And one day, in the library, which is where I was based, which is where I was really happy, the number three governor approached and said to me, Marek, we've just got funding, we're gonna have a full-time Foreign Nationals Coordinator, take the job. I said, no, Chris, get out of here. I don't want to be a suit. I don't want to wear a tie. I don't want to have the prison service badge. I don't want to be going to morning meetings, sitting with the other governors, spending all my time looking at statistics, PowerPoint presentations, boredom, and ultimately on the side of the dark force, you know, like Jedi, yeah? I don't want to be Darth Vader. He looked at me like he knew something I didn't, and of course he did. And he said, Marek, if you don't take the job, you know what's going to happen. It's going to be advertised. And if you're lucky, it's going to be given to somebody who's totally incompetent. Because it's a brand new post, people don't trust it. In the prison service, that's how it works. People don't take chances with their careers. It's all about, you know, getting through to your pension without getting assaulted or developing alcoholic problems. If you're lucky, it'll be somebody who's incompetent. If you're unlucky, it'll be somebody who's a bully. It'll be somebody who takes that job because it's a cushy job. Nobody knows what to expect. Nobody's going to be monitoring it. And they're going to be your boss. And they're going to make your life miserable and the lives of 8,000-9,000 young men in that prison every year also miserable because they will not do what they are paid to do. So, take the job. And I thought, oh, hello. It's not just gangsters that make offers that you cannot refuse, right? It's not just like it is in the films. I became a Foreign Nationals Coordinator for a year, then I was upgraded to Race Equality Coordinator, then a year later, or 6 months later, I was the Head of Diversity. My job involved teaching staff about equalities legislation, my job involved all the festivals to do with Black History Month, Gypsy, you know, LGBT History Month, GTR History Month, liaising with immigration, providing language teaching, all the things to do with equalities. I started working, running a team of six. By the time I left in 2011, I had a team of two. The prison service, the moment in 2009, it was relieved of the responsibility for pulling its socks up to do with equality, because in 2003, following the death of Zahid in that prison, the prison service was found to be institution racist. The moment, 5 years later, they were evaluated and told, you're no longer institution racist, they pulled the funding on all the provision to do with equalities across the board. The same is now true of education, and we've got, you know, Matt Meadows, the art editor of the magazine, Not Shut Up, is here. I know you're doing some research into that. So after all of this, and Feltham, I hear now, is in deep trouble. At the time I was the governor of equalities, we had the highest scores of any prison in the country in terms of equalities. So I was doing something right, with no resources, no training, no etc. I was also the elected chair of the Respect Staff Support Network and the elected chair of the local trade union. So that made me enemy number one for everybody. And the last year I was working in prison, I wasn't doing any of my work, I was just meeting people about bullying, corruption, etc., etc. I think the prison service that I started working for in 2006 is now a very different proposition. For the last 3 years, I've been managing Not Shut Up, this magazine here, which I was a trustee of beforehand. We received a very big grant from the Arts Council a couple of years ago, and in the last 2 years, we have failed to secure any funding. And I think this comes down to a class system which also exists not only in our society, but also exists in the charitable sector, where if you're a small working class charity turning over less than £100,000 a year, you can't bid for bigger amounts of money. But if you manage to find some bigger amounts of money and upscale yourself socially and make that progress, if you become a medium-sized charity, 100,000 to a million, then you can bid for more money. And of course, if you get more than a million, then you can really, really get shed loads of money from all sorts of places. I have failed as the managing editor to fund this baby, and it does take money to produce a magazine because people in prisons still have no access to the internet, even though for a decade or so the government has been wasting millions of our pounds trying to pretend to introduce the internet for prisoners in this country. I don't know what the future holds. Clearly something is bubbling up within our society, and going back to Carlo Gebler and going back to this idea of emotionality, I don't know what the solutions are to the problem of what's happening in prisons today. I don't know what the problems are to do with Palestine or to do with the experience of those who are disabled. We just keep hearing about the fact that money is being withdrawn, lives are being lost. Is there a discourse? Is there resistance? Is there some form of protest? I believe that's what we're here to discuss. So all I will say is that emotionally, even though I have moved to Poland, which is where I was born, and I'm now doing a lot of projects trying to translate literature and export projects such as Not Shut Up, various projects to do with poetry, various projects to do with refugees across Europe, I'm still very much involved in prisons emotionally in some way, and very far from giving up the fight to keep the voices of people in prison, and not just prisoners, but their families, the staff who are working in there, being sent out in constant discussion with the Board of Trustees at Not Shut Up as to what we're going to do next, now that we've been told people, we don't like you, you're not getting any more money from us, and what are the options open to arts charities, which across the country, in the very first year of the previous government, which was the coalition, 6,000 arts charities in Britain went under in 2011 alone. So we're not alone in that sense. What can we do about the feelings that we have about being betrayed, about being shut up, about a huge number of people, whether they're disabled, whether they're refugees, whether they're criminals, whether they're the families of criminals. There are 250,000 children who will be sleeping tonight without a parent because those parents are in prison. What can we do to empower ourselves and get some of that power of the voice coming back? So that's what I hope to be able to discuss with you all today. Thank you very much for listening. Hope that wasn't too stuffy.
Thank you.
So I'm going to need a lectern, a script, and slightly longer of your time because A, I'm an academic, B, I have a lot of jet lag, and C, I only found out yesterday afternoon it needed to be 10 minutes. Martha is a charming, lively woman in her 30s. She loves a good joke, as you can see from this picture of her playing with Emma in the kitchen one evening. Martha has an intellectual disability, and that is why she lives in The Birch, a residential care home in the British town of Ensley, for 5 people with similar impairments. Her disability affects her ability to take decisions, carry out practical tasks, and communicate with others. As a result, people often do not understand her distinctive way of speaking. When she wants to communicate something to you urgently, especially if something is making her scared or anxious, and you do not understand her, she can respond by slapping you squarely in the chest and grabbing your hair. Emma seemed not to be encountering most of these difficulties. A young woman from France, living away from home for the first time, she started working at the Birch a number of weeks after me, and appeared to be getting on with Martha famously. But a couple of months later, Emma was coming down the stairs from Martha's bedroom, and I saw tears in her eyes. She told me that everything had gone wrong, and that Martha had ended up hitting her a lot. We talked hurriedly before Martha emerged from her room and agreed that I would take over. Talking to Emma after, I discovered that Martha had been hitting her ever since she arrived, but that she was too ashamed to tell anyone. Just a few weeks after this incident, Lotta, a young carer from Poland who started working at the Birch soon after Emma, went out with Martha for a pub lunch. All was going fine until Lotta's food arrived first and Martha's was delayed. She didn't realise at the time, but this coincided with some acute pain that came from Martha's syndrome. Quickly, all hell broke loose. Martha started to cry, scream, and throw things. Knives, plates, and glasses went everywhere. She grabbed Lotta's hair and painfully tugged on it. Eventually, she managed to leave, but for her safety, Lotta needed to walk arm in arm with her as they made their way home. Without some space to recover, Martha continued to get anxious and so to hit Lotta as they walked. Martha does not speak in a way others can easily understand. She does not know her way home. She gets scared easily. She has no idea how to use money, crossroads, or make phone calls. So Lotta had to endure this aggression to keep Martha safe. The philosopher Peter Strawson distinguishes between two modes through which we relate to others. Typically, we are what Strawson calls involved. By this, he means that when we interact with others, we are open to feeling what he calls reactive attitudes. These are anger, resentment, gratitude, or indignation. Imagine that from your window you see your neighbour scratching your car. You will certainly experience one of these emotions, and I suspect it's not gratitude. Then imagine you go round to his house to ask him why he did it and how he is going to make up for it. You respond by looking for a response. You are involved. But when he opens the door, he simply babbles something incomprehensible at you. You quickly realise he has a mental illness. Your reaction suddenly changes. No longer do you want a relationship with him to get him to make it up to you. Instead, you stand back and find ways to manage the situation. You cease to respond as if he might respond in return. You are, as Strawson says, detached. Another philosopher called Christine Korsgaard builds on this distinction by saying that when you are involved, you treat someone as a subject, a person, an agent with intentions that you respect and listen to. But when you detach, you treat them as an object, a thing, a part of the natural world that you try to predict the movements of, negotiate around, and control. She argues, following Kant, that we should do everything we possibly can to stay involved with rather than detach from others. This indeed is a widespread ethical aspiration, one that many of us would share with her. We want to find relational, humane, involved ways of responding to people that do not reduce them to automaton. Emma and Lotta wanted to find a similarly relational way to treat Martha. They worried that when they got hit, they might detach from her. But this was not their only fear, for they also discovered that being relational and involved carried its own risks, ones that we would be well advised to attend to. When they tried to hold Martha responsible, to treat her as another person who had reasons for doing what she did, they often became angry and found it hard to refrain from hitting her back. The reactive attitudes have a dark side. Not all involved relations correspond with the nice picture we conjure up when we use the words involvement or relationality. Lotta and Emma found that in the face of overwhelming emotions of anger and resentment in the caring relationship, they needed to detach. Lotta, for instance, told me that the only way she could handle her anger was, quote, not to care, to stay calm, to say it's nothing personal, end quote. But this left them with a dilemma. Should they continue to treat Martha as a responsible subject and risk experiencing reactive attitudes against her that they cannot control? Or should they cease to treat her as responsible and instead see her as a problem to be managed and controlled? The choice between involvement and attachment, relationality and treating someone impersonally is not always as obvious as we imagine. The moral dilemmas that carers face when hit by those they support challenge us to think more critically and creatively about what it means to be good in these situations. So how do carers deal with this dilemma? What moral work do they do to respond to this morally risky situation? Most care organisations in Ensley and across the UK respond to this problem through a division of emotional labour. They train carers to detach in the caring relationship. They are taught not to share personal details with those they support, spend time with them outside of working hours, or do anything which gets close to friendship. This is not because these organisations think friendships with people with intellectual disabilities are impossible or bad, just that it is dangerous for carers to think of care work like this, because of all the aggressive risks of involvement that I just mentioned. So the role of friend is left open to people in public outside of the care provider, but strictly closed to those it employs. Such an approach sounds like a very unrelational and untrusting approach to care. And of course, it is perfectly possible that carers will end up treating people with disabilities as objects, relating to them impersonally and inhumanely as a result. But in my research on care homes that adopted this model, I found that this was not necessarily the case. Carers were often able to detach without treating people with intellectual disabilities inhumanely. In other words, if we think, like Korsgaard, that detaching from someone necessarily leads to treating them badly, then we might need to think again. Many carers refrain from certain kinds of involvement with people with intellectual disabilities, whilst continuing to respect their desires, intentions, and aspirations. In other words, they carried on treating them like a person, just one that they themselves could not be involved with. Korsgaard's understanding of morality is not open to the kind of complex and multi-layered moral work that goes on in these care homes. The main part of my research was conducted on The Birch, a care home that takes a very different approach. It is a large residence that, in contrast to other organisations, a number of carers and people with intellectual disabilities share together. The Birch shares this quirkiness with a number of other care homes in this local neighbourhood in Ensley. People in these houses work, eat, and pray together on a regular basis. They are all run by a charity that is part of an international federation of Christian communities called L'Arche, French for the Ark. L'Arche is premised on the hope that the division of intimate labour in other care organisations is not really necessary, that carers and those they care for can form friendships despite the perils of the caring relationship. L'Arche Ensley hopes, in other words, that carers will not have to delegate the work of involvement to others, but will be able to do it themselves. This approach sounds very relational and involved, and indeed it is. Whilst this may meet our instinctive approval, it also brings with it just the kind of risks I identified earlier, of the reactive attitudes getting out of hand. So carers and large have to learn to do some very sophisticated moral work to leave open the possibility of involvement without it boiling over into an abusive anger towards people like Martha, who sometimes cannot take responsibility for their actions. Many months after the incident with which I began this talk, Emma told me how she came eventually to be good friends with Martha. Even if after 6 months it wasn't hard with her anymore, I still couldn't really forgive her that she was hitting me so much in the beginning. But since we went on holiday together, I can forgive her. I got to know the borders. Since then, she barely hit me, maybe once or twice. But now often I get what's happening in the situation. We can start over again. I'm not going to think that's the person who used to hit me so much. But in lots of ways, it's even harder now when she does. It hurts more because it's your friend who... But on the other hand, I can really see why once it's happened. Also a different kind of hitting. At the beginning, she was really wanting to hurt me. Now it's, I don't know what else to do. It's not as hard, but she can also say sorry afterwards, even if it's only the next day or 2 days away. I know now actually that if it would happen often, I would really question our relationship. That's the thing. I know it's about her disability and her syndrome and her personality, but if she would do it more often, I couldn't call her a proper friend. I want to note two parallel developments in Emma's narrative. First, she has learnt how to take more responsibility in relation to Martha. She speaks of a progression in her understanding of what triggers Martha's hitting and how to not put her in those situations. Second, she has learnt that Martha can actually take responsibility for transgressions, even if unusual ways. She can say sorry after she has hit, even if it is only one day after. This allows Emma to place the moments of hitting in a broader narrative about their involvement, without it creating resentment and anger. But we should note that this newfound involvement does not get rid of moral risk. It, in some ways, increases it. Now more is at stake. There is a relationship that matters and it might not carry on. Emma does say that such a situation will have consequences and sad ones at that, but she does not suggest that this will be either her fault or Martha's. Her and Martha's friendship is a good that just might not be possible to realise. Learning to live with this risk in an already morally fraught environment and one in which a good relationship would be really very helpful for both of them has taken some work for Emma. Eleanor, a central member of the community who has lived there for 25 years, reported something similar. I'll use Martha as an example. I know she knows there are times when I'm annoyed when she's whacked me. I might walk away, but I'm still annoyed, and I defy anyone to tell me that being hit round the chops doesn't annoy you. If you're just saying no enough, that might not sound very positive, but life is not all positive. There are some no's in this world. What makes her so special that she's allowed to get annoyed with me and hit me, but I can't get annoyed back with her? Is it because she has a learning disability? There's stuff when I know it's about her disability and stuff when I know it's not. There's a person in amongst that. I see there's a need for some reality too. If I can't say I don't like that when they do something, that's not my friend. It's still a slight thing with me and Martha. That's all right. It's called learning to trust each other. I don't trust she's not going to slap me, and she's learning to trust me. That's what it comes down to. We can use all the tools in the world, do all the positive things, but you need to find a way to learn to trust each other, and that just takes time. And you can go and be robotic and be exactly how that is, but, you know. Eleanor takes a bolder approach than Emma. She directly integrates her reactive attitudes into the work of care without them boiling over into the logic of abuse. She went on to say, "Love doesn't conquer all, Patrick. We can love people. It's got a lot on it. But there's always going to be a need, Patrick. We think that we can fill all those gaps. We can't fill those big black holes. I've tried. We've all tried at times. You try to make it better as best you can, but you come to realise you can't replace those things." We might say that Eleanor has come not to place limits around involvement, but rather to accept that involvement has limits. Even positive relationality will not solve everything. People are full of such big holes that it is at times impossible to be happily involved with them. Martha's inabilities make it impossible to have a relationship with her at these times. That does not make Eleanor give up on the hope of such relationships, but it, Eleanor says, is sad, even tragic. She can only continue to pursue relationality by accepting its potential loss. In that, she does not blame either herself or Martha for the failures of involvement. She does not assert that it must be someone's fault when relations go wrong. Eleanor accepts that what might block relationality might not be bad intentions, but simply incapacity on both her and Martha's part. In short, Eleanor accepts that this moral risk is part and parcel of what it means to be involved with complicated human beings. Full stop. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, thanks. I feel a bit like Monty Python now for something completely different. when you originally got in contact with me and said, you know, you work on borders, could you come and contribute to our discussion about prisons? I thought, you know, maybe you've got the wrong David Newman there or somewhere. And eventually it's made me spend a lot of time thinking about my work on borders and trying to apply it to sort of the context of prison, of confinement and so on, and raise some conceptual questions. I've never done any work on prisons as such. I suppose the only two areas of contact I've ever had with a prison context, I was telling people over dinner last night, one was that when I grew up in North London, my father was an Orthodox rabbi, and he was also the prison chaplain to Holloway Women's Prison for a few years, and we remember as kids, once every 6 weeks, used to get on his bike and pastor off to the Holloway prison, where he didn't really have anyone to speak to until it came to about a month before Passover, and all the inmates wanted to be Jewish because they got special food consignments at the time. That was one. And the other is that I have an elder son who qualified just 2 years ago. He studied law and philosophy in Jerusalem. And actually, his first 2 years of work, he's been working for the public defense system in Israel, defending the illegal immigrants, a lot of the Palestinians. And he visits the prisons a great deal and tells me a lot about what's going on there, which, of course, we find around the Friday night table just fascinating, because it's not the sort of world that we know as such. But nevertheless, it's raised a number of questions. And let me spend the first 2 minutes just saying what I normally do. Not as dean, but I sympathise totally with you when you said, oh, well, who wants this job and all you do is administration? Well, I'm packing it in after 6 years of deans, because that's what, despite all my good promises to the contrary, you know, they make you into an administrator, whether you want to be or not want to be. But when I do get back to my academic world, I work in the field of geopolitics, particularly in the field of borders. Borders has been a very, very renaissant topic in the past 20 years. Within the social sciences, spreading over to liberal arts and the humanities in recent years, looking at the changing functions and significances of borders, and I suppose coming from the world of what you defined as political geography, whatever that means, and the way that we as people and groups, the way we utilize and manipulate space, territory, the world around us, because basically one of the basic concepts is that we do live in a world of order. Whether we are more disciplined or less disciplined, the world is a fairly ordered and rigid and hierarchical world. And one of the things that creates that order are borders. Borders create order. They create the compartments. And as a geographer, I suppose you think always of the territorial compartments which they create. But of course, whether you're a sociologist or an anthropologist or whatever, we live in worlds of groups and compartments, and they can be vertical groups and cultural groups. And they don't have to be fences or walls to be called borders. The borders can be, you know, a government can come and say, well, you know, anyone who earns below £30,000 a year is in Group A, and anyone over £35,000 in Group B, and that's a border to a certain extent. And all the questions that you raise about borders, about how you cross from one side of the border to the other side, what are the criteria you need? It can be a visa, a passport, a higher wage, a different religion, or whatever, you know, these borders are delimited and demarcated, but they don't always have to be physical borders. And a lot of the traditional work on borders is always thought of borders in terms of states and the international system. And of course, a lot of the discussion over the past 30 years, which of course is now blowing up in our faces, literally in these very days, has been the idea, well, we've moved away from rigid borders. We're moving in globalization on the one hand, European Union on the other hand, the fall of the Berlin Wall on the third hand, and we're moving into this idealized world, a borderless world where spaces and territories are shared and where we can move about freely and where information diffuses freely over the cyberspace and the internet and where borders are no longer significant or relevant. And I think a lot of the renaissance of border studies of the past 30 years, I'm going to talk about this in much greater detail tomorrow in a more formal lecture, is really a sort of a counter-narrative to that, to say, well, you know, the significances and functions of borders are changing, and the way we look at territory and space, but they haven't disappeared. It's just that we need to look at them through different prisms, and then through different eyes, and think more deeply about how we negotiate the spaces within which we interact, within which we live. And that's not just state spaces, they're very much the micro spaces. And that's where, of course, when you sort of, on top of that, you know, gave me the notion of prisons and borders, it led me to think how a lot of the concepts that we use in that discussion could be applied. And what I'm going to do for the next 5 or 10 minutes is just to throw out some questions, really, that I have about that and say, can we apply some of the notions that border studies scholars who come from many, many different disciplines, we cross the borders between disciplines, which, by the way, is a very nice metaphor to explain what crossing borders is all about. So with geographers and political scientists and sociologists and anthropologists, and more recently, a lot of people from the humanities, such as literature and the representation of borders and compartments, etc., etc. It's a very interesting cross-disciplinary debate, even if we don't always understand what the other person really wants us to understand about their use of the term. Often when you get into these hybrid spaces, these cross-border spaces, you know, we're all patting ourselves on the back that we're meeting across the disciplinary borders. And then we go back and say, well, we now know what the sociologist means when she says border, and they know what the geographer means when he says border, but we haven't really got a shared experience out there, which of course is much more difficult to do so. And a lot of the questions that I was thinking about over the past few weeks in terms of this particular gathering was certainly looking at borders and the use of territory in the micro level is sort of what do we mean by bounded spaces and where do borders kick in? For whom do they kick in? Where do they kick in? And where do they become more or less relevant? Because I can look at in terms of the sense of borders or bounded spaces or fortified spaces. Not every bordered space is a fortified space. Some are, some aren't. But of course, I would have thought that the notion of how we look at borders and boundaries is very different for someone who's inside as opposed to someone who's on the outside. There are a number of issues here. This, first of all, how do people on the inside, of which I don't really know a great deal about, so other than sort of listening to my son or watching some movies every so often, how do they relate to the interaction of space inside this very confined world of a prison? Because on the one hand, they are within a very bounded space, and that bounded space is a very fortified space. Certainly in security prisons, they'll be with walls and fences and guards. So it's a space you can't get out of unless you find a way to escape. It's a space you can't get out of. So you are enclosed within that space, yet what goes on within that space is something completely different because there's a whole new hierarchy, I would assume, within that space of who do you share that confined space with? Do you have another set of hierarchies, another set of borders within the prison which keeps certain types from other types? Or is that space shared and is that space therefore very threatening? A lot of the stories that we read about prisons is that once someone is on the inside, you may be in a sense so-called protecting what we call society from that person, that individual, because he's shut away. But what happens inside that space between people who clearly may not, if I can use a British understanding, don't always like each other or get on with each other, and who feels threatened from whom, and when do you have to keep a prisoner in total territorial isolation, exclusion, in order that he or she is safe from the other inmates, and when can they share spaces? So that's one hierarchy of the way we look at space and territory within. That's one sort of hierarchy. A second hierarchy I was thinking about is, of course, that is the idea that when what we call society feels itself protected because the so-called dangerous element, or whatever the correct term to use these days is inside the border, is inside the fortified fence, the fortified wall, and therefore society feels itself protected, what happens when that person then comes out beyond that space? We all well know that the discussions that take place that say people who have been inside for paedophilia now come out of prison, and they therefore have to be registered in some sort of national register. And you have all these complaints, and as soon as someone hears that maybe somebody who's been inside is now coming to live in their street, they'll get up a petition and a demonstration, and they'll go and say, oh, you know, our society, our children are now unsafe because this person has been released. Therefore, we need a new set of hierarchies, a new set of borders, where the best border is to exclude that person altogether and send him somewhere else, a classic NIMBY. Oh, it's very good for someone to have served his due to the community, but don't send him back into my backyard, send him into somebody else's backyard, because he's always going to be in somebody's backyard at the end of the day. And so you set up a new set of borders outside. I was thinking about that to a great extent in a very different context. This past weekend, there's been a lot of discussion in Israel about the American stroke Israeli spy who was released from American prison, Jonathan Pollard, after serving 30 years for spying. And he's now been released onto the streets of New York. I think it's fair to say, I would assume he's a fairly harmless person today. But there's still very important sort of regulations which accompany him as a free man. He can't use the internet, for example. I don't know how you stop people using internets today, to tell you the truth, but because the internet is the classic idea of what an open space is, a borderless space, and that's also a bit of a myth to call it a borderless space. There are very clear borders within the internet, but that's another discussion altogether. But he can't use the internet, he can't leave the United States. So in one sense, he's free from one confined environment, but he's not necessarily free from another confined environment. And depending, of course, what your political perspective on his whole case history is, you believe that this is the correct way or the incorrect way of dealing with him on the outside. But also something else that happens, it seems to me, that when you leave these confined, bounded spaces of prisons, is that it's a bit like when someone's trying to cross a border. We have refugees, migrants trying to cross borders. And they, depending on what they're fleeing from, whether it's political persecution or economic poverty, they will go to great means in order to find their way across that border, particularly if they don't have the legal documents or the legal visas. So they're prepared to pay a lot of money to be smuggled. And in a lot of the cases, the smugglers, you know, take their money and leave them stranded in the desert or in the middle of the sea, and a lot of them die on the way or simply don't get there. But those people that do manage to get the whole way and cross the border, get under the fence or over the fence or around the fence or whatever, and they get into where they're going, and I'm not even talking about the ones who are now rejected by the host societies because they pose some form of new threat or whatever, economic threat, political threat or whatever, those who do get in suddenly find that this thirst for crossing the border, well, they've succeeded in crossing one border, but by becoming now a new ethnic or religious minority in a new host society, they create a whole load of new borders around them. They become part of an ethnic minority where they came from a country where maybe they were part of the majority. They become part of a poor neighborhood where maybe everybody was the same in the previous, in their point of origin. And the question arises, of course, particularly with first generation migrants and refugees, is have the borders that they have crossed, has that been sufficient in order to compensate them for all the new sorts of borders that have been created around them? Now, if you're fleeing persecution and if had you'd stayed there, you'd probably have got killed. Obviously, the answer is however bad it is in the new place, you're still alive and you're working and that's a better situation. But it doesn't apply to everyone. I was thinking of that in the terms of prison that what's one of the great prison films that we've probably all seen a few times? The Shawshank Redemption. And what happens to the old guy? Not the guy who escapes at the end, but the old guy who's been in prison all his life and is finally released and comes into the town and works in the shop. He doesn't know how to deal with the outside world. He has a whole load of new borders around him. The only place he felt really free after 40 years was inside the prison, which is the most confined space. So you know, the question of how you become used to living within what we would see as confined spaces, but maybe the prisoner who's been there a long term sees this as his most natural space. I mean, I'm sure that's something that a lot of people like yourself and social workers have to deal with the whole time, but often they can come out and there's a whole load of new borders, a different world out there. It's a different set of compartments and hierarchies which confine them to a much greater extent than ever did before. So the questions that actually I find very interesting here in relating it to some of the wider issues that we look at in borders in terms of space is, what do we mean when we say, first of all, borders create safety or security? Because we cross borders today. Crossing borders today doesn't mean just a physical crossing. It means the way that we relate across borders. And as I say, I come back to this whole issue today of global violence, global terrorism, the use of the internet, which actually is not an anti-border discourse, as many people think. It's not a return to the borders. It's the way that this new use of space, this new use of cross-border space, is being used and utilized and manipulated by many different groups. Technology is good when it's used in one way. Technology is bad when it's used in another way. You can't stop the advance of technology. So it's not sort of technology and globalization versus borders. It's how borders are renegotiated and reused in an era of internet and cyberspace, which cross the classic concepts of borders. And of course, this idea that someone inside a prison, you were saying that they're trying to put a lot of money into the use of internet, this idea of, does this cross therefore the border? Well, what are the problems involved here? You know, what does it mean when a prisoner who's confined within a very physical wall is able to use freely the internet and the cyberspace? Then the whole notion of how you deal and negotiate the world is very, very different. And one last point I want to make, which relates it to my, my own work, which is more classic on physical borders and security borders, is, of course, we often create borders because we believe, rightly or wrongly, that borders for the in-society, the ones that are included, not the ones that are excluded, are something which, create some sort of sense of safety or security. The West Bank separation wall, which is 3 kilometres north of where I live, the idea has been that it creates sense of security. Tell that to people on the streets in the last few weeks and they'll laugh at you. It's no longer the case, of course. But we also often forget that when you build a wall, and here I'm talking about real physical borders, you may on the one hand create a certain sense of security, because you feel that the perceived threat from the other side is no longer able to enter into your own space. But on the other hand, when you create walls, you create a complete invisibility of what's on the other side, a lack of knowledge. You no longer cross that, and therefore you create a whole new sense of insecurity about what's on the other side, simply by not being there. And I'll end, and I'll talk about this more in my more formal lecture tomorrow, but I've just finished, I'm part of a consortium, an FP7 consortium, looking at borderscapes. And we just completed, together with my research assistant, a very interesting 40-minute video on how do Israeli and Palestinian kids under the age of 10 relate to the physical barrier, the physical wall between the two sides in very sensitive, very contested areas. And, you know, we asked them to, it was very hard to get this work done, as you can imagine, because of all the political sensitivities. But we asked them a series of questions about what do they think is on the other side of the wall and what do they know about what is on the other side of the wall. And of course, they always come up with these pictures of monsters and people with knives and people wanting to take their land away. And they don't even think, it doesn't even cross their minds that, you know, the kids on both sides of the wall on the wall are going to school and they're interested in the same things, etc. I'm reminded the first time they opened the border between North and South Cyprus. Now, if you go to Cyprus, you can go through quite freely. But about 10, 15 years ago, when they opened it for the first time, there was a great article in the New York Times about someone who had grown up post 1974, post division of Cyprus and Nicosia. And he said, I can't wait for them to open the wall, because all my life I've lived on this side of the street. At the end of the street I've seen a wall. And I want to see what these monsters look like on the other side of the wall. And next week they're going to open the wall. I'm going to go through and see what's at the other end of my street. And he goes through and he's interviewed when he comes back. And he says, hey, you know what? They look like me. They speak like me. They eat similar food to me. They're actually very similar to me. But I never knew anything about it, because this sort of big wall that created a sense of, plus, of course, government messages, created a sense of lack of knowledge on the other side. Now, I assume that's true of borders everywhere. I assume it's true of the way we think about prison society, the way people have been in prison and aren't really party to technological change because they're in there for 20, 30 years, think about society as a whole, so that when these walls are opened up to a certain extent, when someone is released or when they come out, they have great difficulty in dealing with the compartments and spaces on the other side and may feel just as imprisoned on the outside as they did on the inside. They're my thoughts here.